Special Committee on Energy was convened at 8:04 a.m. The following House members are present. Representative Co-Chair Millett.
Good morning.
Good morning. Representative Foster. Representative Higgins. Representative Hughes. Representative Josephson. And Representative Nagat.
Good morning.
And myself, Representative Isaacson. I'd like to recognize the staff today, House Recording Secretary Debbie Tillinghast. And to my left is Alex Giudice, is our LIO moderator. Co-Chair Millett's Committee Aide is Jeff Turner, and my Committee Aide is Dave Tallarico. Before we start, I'd like to remind you, because I've been hearing them, please at least mute or turn off your cell phones, and that goes for folks in the gallery. Well, the purpose of today's meeting, which I want to emphasize, is to get an overview of the current Interior Electric Supply. And so we have with us Mr. Corey Borgeson, CEO of Golden Valley Electric Association. And I'd like to thank you for taking time to join us. And also we have Dave Gardner, who is Vice President of External Affairs with Golden Valley as well. And Mr. Borgeson, if you don't mind, as we talked about, if during the presentation we have questions that they could, we could just ask them as you go.
Thank you.
All right. So with that, I turn the floor over to you and your presentation.
Thank you, Representative Isaacson. My name is Corey Borgeson. I'm President and CEO of Golden Valley Electric Association, which serves the interior of Alaska with electrical needs. I am new to this position as President and CEO. I'm taking on the interim position in June of 2012.
One moment. I'm sorry, just to make sure that we're all on the same page. Does everyone have the presentation?
No.
Looks like this.
If
not, oh, there it
goes. Okay. Okay,
no.
We got it. Okay.
Sorry.
Thank you very much. Continue.
Thank you. Anyway, and so I'd be glad to take your questions as I do my presentation. I have probably got about 60 minutes of presentation. We can speed it up or slow it down depending on your questions. Dave Gardner is here with me. He's a vice president. I've been with Golden Valley a number of years, charge of external affairs and member services as well. And from time to time, I'll have Dave participate as well in this discussion. We have a lot of very interesting issues for the interior of Alaska with energy, and energy seems to be a big focus of this year's work in the for all of you here in Juneau. We have some very serious issues with our energy issues in the interior, but I want to start by telling you a little bit about Golden Valley to begin with. We have 34,480 members. This is just our members in our service territory. We go from about the Cantwell area, come all the way through Clear, Nenana, Fairbanks, and then head south and all the way to Delta Junction. With about 44,000 meters. We had a presentation. We talked about the rail belt, of which Golden Valley is a part of the rail belt, and that has about 250,000 members, the cooperatives in the rail belt that they serve. We've developed over the years a very good reliability standard. As many of us live in harsh climate conditions in the state, when it's 40 below zero, it's very important that the electricity stay on. We have our peak demands occur in the most extreme weather conditions. We'll peak at about 220 megawatts. You see we have a generation capacity of our own of about 290 megawatt hours, megawatts capacity. And we have a very diverse way of providing power for our members in the interior.
Mr. Borgeson?
Yes.
On the peak load, how frequent is it at that maximum 220, and then how fast does it dip down to what level?
Yeah. You know, in the summer, our general load would be about 150 megawatts. Of course, the biggest day generally is Thanksgiving. Everyone's got their turkey in the oven, and it's usually cold in the interior, and so we got cars plugged in and extra load like that. Lights in the winter, it's dark. So most of our peak loads occur in the winter.
And define that winter for the committee. Is it Is it simply November to end December, or what?
Yeah, you know, it can be extreme earlier than that. We would say October into the end of March.
So a good 6 months.
Yes. You know, and that's going to be important, too, as we talk about other alternative fuels that we need for the interior, and whether it's space heat. We all have a peak, a need for a lot of energy in the winter months, and then everything kind of sits idle. Our generators don't produce as much in the summers, and they sit. But that's also time then to do maintenance and work on the facilities as well. So some ways it works. Golden Valley is a electric cooperative. It means it's owned by its members. We don't make profits. We have margins. And after a rotation, a period of time, we return our margins to our members. This year, we returned about $2.5 million of capital credits to our members. Dave Gardner's going to help me with some of the questions here because I've told you already I'm new, but I think we're back to the year 1987.
87,
yeah.
Correct.
So any additional funds that we take in from our members during a year is refunded to them after a period of time. Our bankers require that we have margins, in other words, bring in monies in excess of our costs to make sure that we're able to pay back all of our debt. Golden Valley has about $380 million of debt that is necessary for us to have our generation and our distribution system.
That was $380
million? $380 million, debt on our balance sheet. We have about 22% equity, which is on the low side, although I have board members that remind me that when they got on the board 30 years ago, it was down at 14%. I get about 2 minutes per slide here. We're going to be here all day, so I'm going to keep going. But again, please feel free to ask any questions. This next slide shows you where we get our power, and it's changed, if you can see, from 2011 to 2012. We get gas, natural gas production, when we buy power from the Anchorage utilities. We're able to buy power from both MLMP and Chugach Electric. And over the course of many years, we load up on as much of the natural gas power that's generated in Anchorage as possible. And you see, for instance, in 2011, 31% of our production came from the Anchorage utilities. It comes across the interties, and I'm going to talk to you about the interties because they're extremely important to all of the rail belt, including Anchorage and the future of energy projects in the interior and throughout the rail belt, actually. But you can see in 2012, the natural gas power was significantly curtailed. And that is a result of the Anchorage utilities saying that they don't have enough gas to produce electricity for Golden Valley and that they're unable to sell us power. I've got a short video I'm going to show you in a little bit that talks about how we disperse all this power. And they tell you that, hey, they're calling up Anchorage every day saying, do you got any power for us? It's like grocery shopping or... We need electricity, and we want to find the cheapest way of producing it for our members. We produce with coal, and we are going to talk a little bit more about the Healy Clean Coal Plant that we think will come online in the beginning of 2015. We've made big progress on getting that plant restarted, and we think it looks very likely that that will happen. We also have another coal plant in Healy, and...
Mr. Higgins.
A quick question on the Healy Clean Coal Plant, 2015. Is it the permitting process that's slowing that up? Is it the work contract? What's the problem with that?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Higgins, the permitting process did slow us up, but we have our air permits now that were given to us when Judge Beislein signed what's called a consent decree. And we have one other issue that's holding us up, and it's a permitting kind of regulatory process. Our lenders are the Rural Utility Services, which is part of the federal government. In order for them to approve some of the loan transactions that we have to do to do Healy Clean Coal, they have to do an environmental review. It's called a NEPA review. And I want to say that they are cooperating and helping us to expedite this as quickly as they can. We expect all the reviews and everything to be done in July of this year. And then we believe it's an 18-month period of time to get that plant started. And I can give you more details on that. So,
thank you.
All right. So, anyway, one thing I want to point out by looking at the pie charts here showing that we have hydro, which is Bradley, and I'm going to talk about each of these facilities, and now a little bit, and now some wind. We have a very diverse way of producing power for the interior. It's over the years allowed us to have a little bit of leverage with our suppliers, whether it's a coal supplier or a naphtha supplier, that we can, if you can't give us a good price on this product, we can use another one. So we're glad we have the diversity of power. And of course, having gas in the Cook Inlet also allows us to tell our coal supplier and our fuel suppliers that, look, we're going to buy more power over the intertie if you can't give us a good price. Golden Valley is important to a number of industries. The coal mine is an important is important to us, and we're important to them, and as well as the North Pole Refinery. It's a very important relationship. We spend about $65 million a year with Flint Hills Resources, and of course, and they pay us about they pay us a good amount. We try to keep that confidential, and so, but they also pay a big electric bill, as you might imagine. Okay, our electric rates in Fairbanks. Actually, the first time I did the slide, we had 23 cents a kilowatt hour up there. But you're looking at the cost of power. You can see some of our parts of our community are higher than us. Minto with a 22 cents, that's only for the first 500 kilowatt hours under the PCE program. 64 cents when you go over that, and also, yes, Representative.
Thank you. I just want to highlight, you said that the Fairbanks area oftentimes has been up around 23 cents kilowatt hour.
That's correct.
And so this 20 cents is our optimistic range, and that might have just recently taken effect. Or could you explain the difference in the 23 to 20 that you have here?
Yes. What happened is in November, we were able to enter into a contract with Chugach Electric that was going to provide us power over the intertie for the next 2 years, actually until March of 2015, using gas that they're going to get under contract with Hillcorp Corporation. And that was part of an effort to secure gas for Golden Valley for a short period of time, because what you saw from our chart is we were having to rely more on diesel generation. And it's very expensive, as you're hearing from the Anchorage utilities. They're facing the same prospect. So we've got, through Chugach Electric, a gas contract, which we're very glad to have. That allowed us, for our quarterly cost of power adjustment, to drop the rates almost 3 cents a kilowatt hour.
So even though we're getting much less, almost half of the natural gas that we had previously, or is in 2013 the wedge of natural gas from your previous slide going to increase again to actually demonstrate that cost reduction?
That's correct. 2013 is going to look more like 2011.
Okay.
So we have, I call it a bridge. We have a two-year bridge, and that's going to play into when Healy Clean Coal starts. And so I've said to my board that we have, after 2013, after this contract that starts in April 2013 and goes until March of 2015, we've got somewhat of a fix with Healy Clean Coal starting. I'll talk more about the cost of that.
Yes, Representative Hughes.
And when the Healy Coal comes online, how will that impact rates?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, we believe that cost of Healy Clean Coal is going to be somewhere around 12 to 14 cents a kilowatt hour. To give you an idea, that the diesel or HAGO frame 7s that we run in North Pole, the fuel costs alone on those units are about 23 cents a kilowatt hour. So the Healy Clean Coal will as far as our general mix of costs, will drop that cost of production significantly. And the other thing about the coal production is it's steady. The cost is fairly even. It doesn't go up and down like oil costs do. And we're able to get a 5-year, maybe potentially 10-year contract with our coal supplier. So it'll be a steady, reasonable cost of power. Now, I'd like to kind of remind everyone here that when that plant was built and was supposed to come online in 2000, it was supposed to produce power at about 4.5 to 5 cents a kilowatt hour.
Just to clarify, you said 12 or 14 cents for the coal. Is that just for the segment that's coal, or is that the overall rate? You could bring the 20 cents down to 12 or 14 cents?
Through the chair, no, that's just for the segment that's coal. We think that the cost of power is going to stay in about the 20-cent range and maybe go down a couple pennies, down a couple cents, hopefully not go up. What we're trying to do is to ensure that our cost of power can remain steady at this rate. It's a high rate, and I'll talk to you more about that. And I sometimes tell people, you know, I'm working on making sure that our rates are going to be more comparable to Anchorage rates. And I can say that not because I think we're going to drop ours so much, but I believe that you're going to see the Anchorage rates are going to go up.
Greg Pickens.
Just out of curiosity, on your 20 cents per kilowatt hour, does that include the fuel surcharge?
Yes, it does.
When has it been 20 cents per kilowatt hour? For how long? Has it been for the last 6 months? Has it been for the last month? What are we quoting the 20 cents from?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Higgins, it started December 1, 2012. It dropped from 23 cents to 20 cents, and we announced that we had a 22% reduction in our cost of power, which resulted in an overall reduction in our cost of about 11% to our members that came in December 1. And it's based basically on the expectation that we're going to be able to get gas fired generation from Anchorage.
Thank you.
Electric costs are part of the issue in the interior, but the real issue that we've got and what's driving to what people call an energy crisis in the interior is our space heating costs. I call it the sexy part of this discussion. It gets everyone's attention, and this chart was done by the Fairbanks North Star Borough and was developed through a study that they had commissioned, came from Northern Economics. But it shows in Fairbanks, June 2012, that we're paying $4 a gallon for heating oil, and that if Anchorage was paying the comparable price in natural gas, you'd be paying $31.84 in MCF. When in fact Anchorage is paying about $11 in MCF. I misspoke. Let me say you'd be paying about $31.84 in MCF, and you're paying about $11 in MCF. So the cost of space heating in Anchorage is about a third of what it is in the interior. And the other comparable is that if we were paying the same cost for energy for space heating our homes in Fairbanks as you are paying for natural gas, we'd be paying about $1.38 a gallon for heating oil. So it's a very dramatic cost. I was invited with a number of organizations to meet with the governor, and I'd had my oil tank filled the day before, and you get a little slip when they fill your heating oil. You come home, you see that yellow thing hanging on your door, and you kind of take a deep breath. And I do have a big oil tank. I have a 1,000-gallon tank, and I'd gotten 700 and some odd gallons, and my bill was $2,800. So I took it and showed it around and gave it to the governor and joked that maybe you want to put it in the budget or something. But it's very serious. The typical home, the rule of thumb that I've always heard is that if you use about in gallons about half your square footage. So if you have a 3,000 square foot house, you're going to use 1,500 gallons a year. And at $4 a gallon, that's $6,000 a year in heating oil costs. It's big. And then you add your electric costs on top of that, and the energy costs in the interior. Like you've heard about the villages, we're very sympathetic to the cost of energy in the villages as well, is causing people to say they can't afford to live in the interior. So we take a look at the impacts to our community on our rates and our energy costs. And, you know, I came in to Golden Valley as Prem CEO, and I look and I said, well, you know, the typical residential user of electricity uses about, and it's dropping by the way, I'm going to use a 700 kilowatt hours. It's a little bit under that now. It used to be 750. And for 20 cents, by the way, that 20 cents is a kilowatt, cost of a kilowatt, does include our charge, our monthly service charge, which is $17.50. But the average residential, the average usage shows a bill of about $150 a month, and that's $5 a day. I said, well, what's $5 a day? To be able to come home and turn on your lights and have your refrigerators run, that's not too bad. And I said, you know, that's what people are paying when they are in line at one of those coffee kiosks and getting a latte. And by the way, Dave's department said, stop saying that, Corey, because that's elitist. Not everyone can afford that, and don't, you got to recognize that. But what you start to recognize is that while some people can't afford $5 a day when they have all the other costs that are spiraling, the electric costs impact us in many ways. Our restaurants have to charge more for their foods. Fred Meyer has to charge more for his products because they've got very large electric bills and space heating bills to pay. We can't save as much. The contract from Chugach Electric, dropping those rates, we did, is going to save our members in 2013 $34 million. And that is significant. So it has a cascade effect. And I want to tell you that one of the other things that happened is that after I came in Golden Valley, I was invited by one of our larger customers, our largest customer, to come get a tour of their facility. And it's a very impressive operation. They've got 720 employees. They say they've got a capital budget of improvements of over $100 million a year. And they say, and it was a very nice tour, they treated me like I was important. And at the end, they sat me down in a room, much smaller than this, and said, our vice president is in town. He wants to talk to you. And he said to me that our electric rates are too high for them to do business, and that they can employ their capital anywhere across the world to do this this mining, and that if we can't get our electric costs down, their headquarters is saying, why should we spend all this money in this community? It's too expensive to do business here. So you start realizing that the energy cost has a significant economic impact on the community. While in one way you might think it's just not that big for a residential person to pay their electric bill, from the standpoint of industry and economic growth and development, it does have a significant impact.
Yes, Mr. Representative Philson.
Thank you, Chairman Isaacson. Mr. Bergeson, Andy Josephson, representing Anchorage. I spent 5 years in rural Alaska, and so I'm familiar with the sort of the fuel oil or diesel, it's called, as well, right? So they're sort of synonymous?
Yes.
Okay. With the model of the large drum feeding through a gravity feed filter and into the house. And when I visited Fairbanks, you see that even in downtown. What would be the cost associated if there was a natural gas line, an HB9 model from last year or any model, and Fairbanks was retrofitted to a natural gas design? How would you receive it? How would all these homes receive that? And what would be Golden Valley's role in that?
Through the chair, a brief answer to that is there's been a study that was done with borough grant monies and seen overseen by the Fairbanks Development Economic Corporation, and they pegged the cost of that at $400 to $600 million of putting in a distribution system throughout the borough area. If I'm answering your question, others say that It wouldn't be that expensive. I've not studied it, and so I don't want to make a representation as to the cost of that. You know, I've read the studies, and they're out there. But it's a big cost to put in a natural gas system. There is a small natural gas system already in place in Fairbanks that provides natural gas to about 1,000 customers. And Golden Valley's role in this, we think we have a role in bringing natural gas to Fairbanks, and we're thinking that there's a role for someone else, the natural gas utility that's already there. A borough utility has been formed to provide natural gas distribution systems. We think they're well suited to do the distribution. That answers your question.
It does.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I guess if that $400 to $600 million wasn't invested, then you're really talking about fuel oil prices and moving fuel oil in a cheaper fashion. Isn't that right?
Well, I guess you're talking about the cost of, through the chair, yeah, I guess you're talking about the cost of fuel oil. I don't know if you can move it much cheaper. Hopefully the efficiencies that we've developed in developing moving fuel oil is as good as can be. I mean, that's what we've been existing on, heating our homes with fuel oil that gets delivered into a tank and mm-hmm. flows down to your furnace. I don't know how you can deliver it cheaper. The cost, if we can get the cost down, I can remember paying 85 cents a gallon for heating oil. But, heating oil goes up, that means the diesel cost goes up, so the cost of delivering it goes up.
Thank you.
Okay. I want to spend a little time going over our generation facilities, and I've got pictures here. I'm going to go through each one. We have an interest in the Bread Lake Hydro plant. We're calling it 15 megawatts. Sometimes we refer to it as 20 megawatts because it really will produce 20 megawatts, but we have some constraints over the intertie that really only allow us to get 15 megawatts of power over Bradley Lake. Bradley Lake is maintained by Homer Electric under agreement of all the participants in Bradley Lake. It's been an extremely good facility for Golden Valley. The power out of this comes to us at about 6 cents a kilowatt hour. So we're very pleased to get our Bradley power. It comes over the intertie. We have line losses associated with it and things like that, but it's still a very good way to provide to get energy to the interior. There's a Battle Creek diversion program that we're working on to increase the flow into Bradley Lake, and that is something that is ongoing at this time. The Bradley Lake is actually owned by the Alaska Energy Authority of the state. It was a project that was done in the early 1990s, and it was done basically by a 50% grant from the legislature, so thank you again, and also 50% finance that was being paid back by the utilities. So we're very glad at Golden Valley that we have an interest in Bradley Lake. Originally, part of the interest in Bradley Lake was owned by the Fairbanks Municipal Systems, and when we bought their electric system, also in the 1990s, we got their interest. We have there's two coal plants in Healy. The plant that's in the foreground in the picture is our Healy plant. It's 28 megawatts. It was built in 1967. It produces power also. Our fuel costs out of that plant are also about 6 cents a kilowatt hour. And it's a very reliable plant. It's getting older, but we maintain it very well. We make sure we keep our environmental upgrades done, and we're glad it's there in Healy. The plant behind it is the Healy Clean Coal Plant. It's a 50 megawatt plant, and again, as we talked about already, we hope to have that running in 2015. You can't really tell from the picture, but the plants are connected. They were just built that way so that there could be one control center for both plants. The Healy Clean Coal Plant is owned by ADA, the state of Alaska. And under the original scenario, ADA was always going to be the owner, and Golden Valley is going to pay a lease payment for 20 years and operate the plant. We now have an agreement with ADA to purchase that plant from them. And I've got an update for you on Healy. We'll kind of save that for the end. We are glad to have our Eva Creek Wind project. Again, there was approximately $13 million of grant money from the state. Again, that's very much appreciated. The towers were constructed this past year and put into operation in November. It is operating extremely well. There are 12 turbines generating about 24 megawatts of power at maximum. Over the period of time that it operated in 2012, we're at a 53% capacity factor, which is a phenomenal capacity factor for wind. But we anticipated the capacity would be much higher in the winter because the data that we've gotten on the wind shows that it does blow more in the winter, and so we knew there'd be more wind then. I've got a short video I want to show you, if I might see if I can do this without deleting something, and about the construction of the Eva Creek Wind. We're very proud of this project. It came on budget, in time. Let's see. If you can hear it. But it came in on time and on budget, and you realize that it was sited on Eva Creek, which is close to the Healy Clean Coal Plant. But in order to get there, all the workers only had to cross the Nanana River, walk across a railroad bridge. All the infrastructure, everything there had to come on railroad car, so it was a good year for the railroad. All these blades had to come on railroad cars, shipped in from Anchorage. The blades that they're lifting here were built in Arkansas, and they're constructed of fiberglass, balsa wood and fiberglass. We had a work camp that was set up there in Ferry, Alaska, and at the peak we had 205 workers working on this plant. We used all Alaska labor. Our contractor, who is out of Wisconsin, it's Michael's Wind, complimented us on our high quality of labor that they had, as they had to work with them. They work with labor forces all throughout the country. The towers were made and constructed in Korea, and then the cells, that's a big, I call it a big motorhome that goes on top of the tower, were constructed by Repower in Germany. The crane itself came from California. There wasn't one large enough in the state, and the boom itself took 6 railroad cars to get here. So there's a lot of logistics in building this project, and it really came together well, just like those blades did.
So, Mr. Borgerson, how many of these impressive generators are currently producing?
Well, today I haven't checked, but there's 12 of them that have all been commissioned and have all been working.
So 12 is the total number, or 28? 12?
12, and they're a little, they might get the exact, they're 2.2 or 2.2 megawatts per tower, and there's 12 of them.
Okay. And any output figures yet available?
Well, like we say, we anticipate 78,000 megawatt hours per year, and I can't remember the exact number. Maybe Dave has it.
Well, I don't have it with me right now, but it would be the 25 megawatts times 30 days times 24 hours times the 56% capacity factor would be the formula that we would use to calculate that, and I can get that for anybody as soon as I get it calculated.
Yeah, and so it's too early yet to see if the projections are and the performance are agreeing.
Well, what we see so far is that they're performing better than we anticipated. So we think it's an extremely successful project. And
what does that mean to the use of our Hagel plants? How much reduction of use will that
There's a reduction in our fuel costs on that. You know, and I've seen the numbers in over a million gallons in reduction of the HAGO and naphtha as well. Most of the generation that we use in conjunction with the wind project is going to be the North Pole Expansion Plant, which is operated on naphtha.
So comparing the three towers at Kodiak, they get about a million gallons of reduction too. Is this going to be comparable, or we'll get less value from it because of the different wind trains?
Much bigger. And I believe it was a million gallons in 2012 that we saved. So we're going to be much bigger than the Kodiak plant. And I think they've got six wind turbines now. They started with three. Also a very successful project. So it's going to reduce significantly our oil needs.
And when did it come online in 2012 then?
You know, they started producing at the very end of October, okay. But not much, really November and December.
So a million gallons just in those 2 months.
That's correct.
That's good. Mr. Nagai.
A million gallons during that time period or a year?
No, just during that time period, if I understand you correctly.
Yeah, so just during that time period.
So hopefully that'll be magnified six more times. Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be significant. You know, I had a steep learning curve here on some of the generation issues because I didn't come from a generation background. But, you know, when you have wind on your system, you have to be prepared for it to stop working. You can't just turn it on and say, we're going to get it. You know, the wind blows and it doesn't. And, in fact, you know, I'll call our dispatch center, and I got a video of that I'm going to show you. It's very interesting. And I'll say, hey, how much wind are we getting? They'll say, oh, they iced up. You know, so we've only got four units that are going right now. We're only getting 8 megawatts of power. So what happens is, or they say the wind stopped blowing. We're not getting anything right now. Or sometimes they call and say, oh, we're getting 24 megawatts. But, you know, or the wind died last night. We were getting 24. Now we're only getting 8. So what you have to do and for the dispatching of power is that you've got to have something ready to spin, to go. They call it spinning, in the event your wind stops. So you always have to have some type of unit going to be prepared for the wind to stop. So I've got to have a big enough unit at Golden Valley for the dispatch that's going for the 24 megawatts. And the most likely unit for that, because it's also the cheapest, is our North Pole Expansion Plant that burns naphtha. But it's like, the wind's stopping. What we have to do is we have to throttle up the turbine in North Pole and burn more naphtha at that point in preparation. So there's always a consideration with wind is how much wind can you have, because you have to be prepared to back it up, so to speak. In Fairbanks itself, this is the Zender plant. There's two what we call frame 5 GE turbines there. You notice when we have a power facility, you'll see that we have generally backup. We have two different units. So if one goes down, the other one will work. It's part of the reliability. So rather than put in one 40 megawatt unit, we put in 220 units. Zender power plant is one of our older plants. It's very expensive. It's 53 cents a kilowatt hour for fuel costs.
How much was that?
53 cents a kilowatt hour. So we don't burn it very often. It's also basically downtown Fairbanks, off Illinois Street, and we have environmental issues, as you probably all know. So we don't use it that often. But sometimes when we just need a little bit of power, you'll see that Zender is running, because it's cheaper to run an expensive unit than run a big unit when you don't need it all. So. Again, the Zender units, you can't see, but off to the right is another small generator. So I call our Black Start unit. And I kind of joke, you can actually go out there with a little rope and a cord and start an engine, and to make sure if we're all completely black that we can start all these units up. So we got to have electricity somewhere to start our units. So this is part of our backbone of our system. In North Pole, this plant was built in the early 70s. There's two 60-megawatt frame 7s, GE turbines there. They're also expensive to run. I already mentioned this. They're 23 cents a kilowatt hour for fuel costs. And we've been running them more. This is what we've been running when we haven't been able to get power from the Anchorage utilities. But they're reliable and they work, and they're not the most efficient plants, but they're not the worst. Right next to it, we have our North Pole expansion plant. This was built in 2005, and it runs on an LM6000 turbine. Total output of this plant is 60 megawatts. The turbine itself puts out 47 megawatts of power. It's basically it's a GE turbine. It's a GE jet engine that they use also in 747 airliners. And it runs on a lighter fuel called naphtha. It burns cleaner. It's better for the environment. We have a combined, it's called a combined cycle plant because we have a steam turbine that operates off the exhaust of this jet engine, and it creates another 13 megawatts of power off the exhaust. So while it's more expensive to build, it's a more efficient plant. This is what we call a baseload plant, and it runs all the time, and this is the plant we use to back up the wind, that we can pull it back and throttle it back. So, by the way, we still think our wind power is going to come in at the 12 cent kilowatt hour cost. One other thing I might add about the wind project, if I back up just a second, is that the financing for that was low interest rate because there were federal energy bonds available called Krebs bonds, and our financing cost on there is 1.05%. So it's a very the cost of the financing really reduced the cost of that project. In Delta Junction, we moved a turbine that was in Fairbanks, on the banks of the Chena, out to Delta. As our growth in the Delta Junction area has expanded, we thought it was prudent for reliability purposes to have a facility out there, and we moved it. I think it was also about 2005, mm-hmm. maybe a little bit earlier. It's very expensive to run. I defer to Dave if he knows, but it's so high I don't even want to know. Maybe over a dollar kilowatt hour.
In the neighborhood of a dollar.
So we started up to make sure it runs a couple times a year, just kind of reliability testing. It's there if we need it. And again, as you hear from the Anchorage utilities about what they're facing with the shortage of gas and the need to have energy in the Anchorage Basin, sometimes it doesn't matter what it costs, you've got to have it. So it's there for us if we need it. We also purchase power, and I've got a picture there of the Aurora Energy coal plant. This used to be owned by the city of Fairbanks, and it was bought by a group of folks that are aligned with the Yucabeli coal mine. They operate this plant. It's 25 megawatts. It's been very reliable. They've put a lot of environmental upgrades into it. It's sitting on the banks of the Chena. So in one way, we like it, that it's right there where our load is. Not a lot of line losses, and it's been very reliable. In other ways, we'd like it to be somewhere further away from our containment areas. And then, yes.
While you're on coal, if I may, then I'm glad you're showing the Aurora. What about any power purchases available from Fort Wainwright, Eielson, or Clear?
You know, and I maybe have Dave speak to you a little bit more about this. It was never designed for us to purchase power from Eielson. Or Fort Wainwright, but we have a wheeling tariff that allows for sharing of the lines and includes the price comparison where, in effect, we are buying some power from Fort Wainwright at this time. Mm-hmm. Dave, can you give more detail on that?
A little bit, and one clarification should be made, and that is that the power plants at both Wainwright and Eielson are not power plants. They're heat-generating plants because that provides all the heat for the bases during the winter, and electricity is essentially a byproduct. So on a cold day in the winter when they're producing a lot of heat, they will have a little bit of excess power that they might be able to sell to us, but it's primarily a backup. It's not one of our larger sources of, power by any means. In the event that their power plant should fail, we can, of course, provide them through the same wheeling agreement, but during the winter, once again, we can't provide them with any heat. So they never forget the fact that if their power plant should go down, we can provide them with the lights and they can watch themselves freeze. So,
would you renew that discussion with Eielson then, because their leadership within the past year has expressed frustration at the fact that they do purchase electricity, mm-hmm. but are only able to sell it back at a higher amount, so it isn't economic for them to do it, and they've been frustrated because they insist that their costs could be lowered and we could have lower utility rates at times depending on our mix. But they've expressed frustration, and especially since we're going through this Eielson pre-EIS stuff, if you could renew that conversation with them and maybe pinpoint some of their frustrations, and maybe they have more electricity capability spin than we're giving them credit in this testimony.
Okay, we'll get back with you on that.
Thank you.
To the committee.
Mr. Higgins?
And just a quick comment, you know, as far as the clear base goes, power plant, you know, they've been dumping extra juice in the ground for years, and I can't understand why we haven't been able to use that juice. Why are they dumping it?
Well, let me through the chair, Representative Huggins, if I might, it's a timely question. Clear has recently come out and advised us that they want to connect to the system. For one thing, in the past, there's been no connection between the Clear Air Force Base there, which is in between Denali National Park and Fairbanks, and Golden Valley's grid. So they never wanted to connect up and didn't want to be... It just never happened. So they've advised us that they want to connect to the grid and take power from us. They also put out for proposals to basically lease or sell or somehow transfer their coal facility. They have a 20-megawatt coal plant there. And it might be 22 megawatts, but in that range. They only need 4 megawatts of power. So when your observation, they've been dumping in the ground, they just haven't been spinning it. It's very inefficient to have a big plant, that size plant, and only use 4 megawatts. It takes the same number of people. You understand the economy of scale. And they want to have someone take that plant over and produce power. And Golden Valley went out. We hired Sterling Engineering to take a look at that plant and look at everything that we can find out about it and to see if we're interested in taking over that plant. There are other groups that went out and looked at it. Dorian Utilities, which operates the Fort Wainwright base and Fort Richardson, I believe, down here in Anchorage, and took a look at it. Aurora Energy looked at it. And nobody responded. Nobody was interested. And I can give you a short answer why. One is it was being proposed that it would come with no environmental permits. So you're going to have to go out to the EPA and get a permit to operate a coal plant. And with our utilities just spent 5 years working on getting an environmental permit for Healy Clean Coal, while we think we've got a little bit up in the learning curve, we just didn't want to push our luck. We weren't sure it would ever happen. And you're going to have to put a lot of money into something that you don't know is going to work. So it came without any environmental permits. And looking through the Clear plant, there were some reports on the turbines there having potential for critical failures. It was a used plant. Well-maintained, I hear, I'm told. But as we looked at it from Golden Valley, with a keen interest in acquiring it and taking it over, we just thought it was a fairly high risk. And there's also a question about how much we could bring over the interties coming into Fairbanks if we load up that plant and we're getting Healy Clean Coal started as well. Of course, we can send some power south. So I don't know if the Anchorage utilities, I didn't hear of any of the Anchorage utilities that looked at Clear, but Golden Valley took a pass on it, but after due consideration, and the the end of the day is nobody expressed any interest in the Clyra plant. And I can only tell you that I believe very intelligent people looking for opportunities looked at it and just thought it didn't work.
Follow.
Good.
Mr. Borges, how long have you lived in Fairbanks? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah,
I don't know.
1982. I
1982. Right. Okay, good. Intertie, when was that put up? That was, what, 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah, I got that. The Alaska Intertie was built in the 1980s. The Northern Intertie that we built was built in the 1990s.
90s, that's what I thought. Okay. And from my understanding, I guess right now we have a problem with the Intertie not being up to date enough to put more juice on it. Is that correct or not correct?
That's correct. There are some constraints on the Interties.
Was that because?
Follow up.
I'm sorry. Was that because of the technology at the time, or why didn't we build it so that we knew we were going to eventually grow?
Well, I think you're looking at your mix of where your power is going to come from. The additional intertie was built to accommodate the Healy Clean Coal Plant, and so it does that. And with Healy Clean Coal coming on, which is another 50 megawatts, we've got plenty of capacity. We've got plenty of ways to produce power in the interior. What's happened to us, and if you want to be critical, is that we have a big dependence on oil-fired generation. And, if oil was at $10 a barrel, that would have other ramifications, of course. We'd have very cheap power. So we have the capacity on our banks, and when you talk to the engineers that have to make sure that our system's reliable, and to our board members who are very concerned about reliability, it's very important to have generation within our system. So if an intertie goes down, if we can't get our power through the interties, we need to make sure we can produce power in Fairbanks for our members. So I don't know, it's a long answer maybe.
And you're actually going to be dealing with the intertie on several slides here.
Yes.
And some of our difficulties with that, the obstacles for getting some of the molecules coming up from Bradley Lake and so forth.
That's correct.
Okay. So if we want to defer that, okay. Thank you.
And again, I want to point out the power purchases are very important to us. As I already explained, this two-year contract with Chugach Electric saving $32, $34 million in 2013 and maybe more in 2014. The savings, I'm always cautioned about talking about savings because it's relative. It's relative to what the cost of oil is. If oil goes up, the savings are greater. If oil goes down, the savings are less. So,
and here you have that intertie limit. Maybe you might want to speak a little bit more to that since it had to do with Rep. Higgins' question.
Yeah. To come over the intertie, we're limited to about 77 megawatts of power. And we have some constraints on the intertie, on the Alaska intertie. It's operated at 138 kV, and some of the interties have been built to be 236, but that one hasn't been. And I'm not an engineer, so I have a hard time really giving you the complicated answer. But it's kind of like we got a big power cord, but in the middle there's a smaller extension cord that just can't bring that much power over it. And remember, we want to bring our Bradley power all the way to Fairbanks, too. So if we got 15 megawatts of power, sometimes we can get 20 megawatts of power from Bradley at a time when nobody else wants their Bradley, which does happen. You get so much, by the way, Bradley, you get so much water here, you can use it and dispatch it hopefully when you want it. Sometimes it depends what everyone else wants as well. But we're going to bring our Bradley across, so that means we're kind of limited to how much we can bring from Chugach or MEA, so we have 60 megawatts there. And that's our limit, so we'd buy more power from the south. And I'm going to show you I've got some diagrams of the interties and how it was built out. That's coming in the presentation. But maybe for a short answer, that kind of helps here. Okay. But, So I got a picture of the Aurora Energy coal plant. It's, and I kind of talked about that, 25 megawatts. Very low cost. That's under contract. It's 5.8 cents a kilowatt hour. That's the cost of that. This is why when we get to our total cost of power at 10 cents, we got some very expensive generation, we got some very cheap generation, and it averages at that. You know, how we decide to dispatch all this power is kind of an interesting look, and I've got a short video for that for kind of a little bit of diversion. So if you give me a second here, I'd like to cue that up for you. Oh, this one's quiet. Can we turn the volume up, please?
You can put the microphone next to
it. Yeah, let's do that.
Even if you have to go out of your way to get there. At GVEA, we do the same thing when we produce and purchase power. We go out of our way to find the lowest cost power and the cheapest fuel for our power plants. We always buy or produce the least expensive power we can get, and that means savings on your electric bill.
My name's Henry Dale. I'm the Power Systems Manager here at Golden Valley Electric. My job is to figure out which units we need to run to make the most economical power for our members.
GVEA has 9 different power sources it can draw from. The dispatchers take as much power as they can get from the least expensive sources.
On a difficult day like today, we're trying to get as much economy energy as we can out of Anchorage. We usually get a good price on the natural gas down there.
Okay, it's Jeremiah. We're looking for some more power. You got any available?
Our most inexpensive powers are coal plants, and we run those flat out all the time. Then to balance things out, we use our Bradley Lake, which there's only so much water for the year, so we use the right amount of water for the day, and then the rest is oil fired. We of course, run our most inexpensive units first, and then our more expensive ones afterwards.
But Golden Valley doesn't have enough cheap power available, so it has to burn oil, and that's expensive.
You can see that we're running a little under, just under $10,000 an hour in our fuel costs and generation.
When you're spending that kind of money on fuel, it's important to make every bit count. GVEA has sophisticated software that calculates the optimum fuel mix for reliability and lowest cost.
We do the economic calculations. We have a program that runs every minute automatically, looks at the system, looks at what units I have online, and calculates what the best mixture of those units are. Our automatic generation control system is making control corrections every 4 seconds to ensure that we're getting the cheapest possible mix for our customers.
Every 4 seconds, Golden Valley adjusts its fuel mix to minimize the use of oil and maximize the use of cheaper fuels.
Compared to oil-fired, our coal is cheap, our wind is cheap, gas-fired energy out of Anchorage is cheap, relatively speaking. But oil-fired, as anybody who gets fuel at the pump knows, it's just gotten outrageous these last several years.
This is just one way that GVEA is working hard to kick the oil habit, and that means real savings for our members.
Through our calculations and our minute-by-minute scheduling, we can save $100,000 a day in a cold winter-type day. It's not simply just turn on the generators and go home. We're at it hour by hour, minute by minute. I've got people dedicated to finding cheaper power every day.
So, important part of what we do at Golden Valley is dispatching that power. And again, you know, if hindsight is 2020, and looking back, you know, you'd say boy, if we just built more coal, if we built a bigger intertie system, we'd be better off. But it is what it is at this point, and we do the best we can to keep the cost down. So a little bit about understanding what our bill looks like. We have three components to our electric bill. We have a kilowatt hour charge, what we call the fuel and purchase power charge. We used to call it the COPA, the cost of power adjustment, and we changed the name. We're having a hard time with that. But anyway, the 10.802 cents kilowatt hour charge used to be in the 13 cent range, and that's what dropped December 1, 2012. The utility charge, which is 9.5 cents, 9.6 cents, is our cost of operating all of our facilities. It's salaries, it's depreciation, interest expense, it's sometimes anything that's not included with the cost of power, except the fact that we have a customer charge, which is part of the charges that are deemed to be necessary to hook up to our system, some of the basic parts of our costs. And actually, Dave can maybe expand on that a little bit for me, on the what's on the customer charge.
The major parts of the components of the customer charge, Mr. Chair, are the components that would be there regardless of how much power you used. We still need to have the people read the meters. We still need to have the people in the lobby ready to answer the phones and address the members' concerns. So those are the costs that are rolled up. They're not affected by the amount of power that you use, the amount of fuel that you use. They're the fixed costs.
Our utility charge, by the way, and our customer charge and the fuel purchase power charge is all regulated by the commission, Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Our utility charge is on what's called a simplified rate filing system, where every 6 months we file with the Regulatory Commission our cost for a 12-month period of time. So it changes every 6 months. So we've worked, and we're working hard, and we're going to talk about our conservation program at reducing our costs and dropping our utility charge costs. It's sometimes, you say, well, we're spending $1 million a year on training. Let's cut down our training budget or cut down another budget. When you talk about $1 million, you talk about $500,000 or $300,000, it's not a significant change in the bill to the customer. But we've embraced the Golden Valley best business practices. We're not measuring about how much it's going to reduce our members' bills. What's the best business practice to do here? And we're seeing that we can get more efficiencies. We're more attuned to it. And, you start adding up the hundreds of cents, and pretty soon it's a penny, and then pretty soon it's a little bit more. But that cuts into reliability. We talk and customer service. We talk about, could we cut back our hours of our lobbies? So we have customer service in Nanana and in Delta Junction. Do we have to have those outlying branches? And we're looking at any type of expense. And so there's got to be a fair balance of service and reliability in the system. If we have an engineer resign, do we not replace them? But then we're down one engineer, and when you need them, what are you going to do? So it's something we're always looking at, and we're, like I say, embracing this best business practices.
Jeff Higgins.
Getting back to your electric costs, this 10 cents, 0.8 per kilowatt hour is the utility charge. That's what it costs to generate that energy, right? Am I understanding that right?
That's correct.
And the 9.597 cents per kilowatt hour is the cost of personnel. That we have to pay our personnel. I mean, that's what that's in there, or no?
Through the chair, yeah. Yeah, and let me expand on a little bit more, because I maybe nodded and said, yes, you're right. The fuel and purchase power charge is the cost of our fuel. It's the cost of our coal, our $65 million to Flint Hills. It's all of our costs of energy over the intertie, all those things. And then the utility charge is the cost of the plants, of operating the plants, personnel, salaries, Dave's my salary. But it's also the cost of our depreciation and our interest expense, the cost of having all these facilities.
All right. Follow up. So the customer charge of $17.50, which have 34,480 members, comes up to $603,400 per month that you're getting. What do you use that money for?
And again, that's used to cover the, like Dave said, the basic cost of being hooked to our system, our meter readers.
But that's a follow-up. That's a one-time. You guys come out, hook me up. You don't have to come out again. You do have to read the meter, I guess, somehow.
Yep.
But it's a one-time hookup. I mean, and I've been there for years and years and years. So what does the $603,000 per month go to?
It includes routine maintenance on the line. Anything that is required to maintain your connection to our system, regardless of how many megawatts you might use. Transformers wear out, lines wear out, things have to be upgraded.
Okay.
You could, through the chair, some follow up. You might look at it's the cost of your being hooked to our line. And that if you didn't use anything, you're still costing us $17.50 a month. And, you know, I don't think we've given you a very good answer here, but we've got it. What's happened here on the rates is the rate design is that the regulatory commission looks at it. We have to spread it all out in spreadsheets, and they allocate the right charges. The customer charge, $17.50, is the cost of a residential customer. We have different costs for small businesses and for large industrials that are much higher than this. And again, it's based on this concept of cost causer, cost payer, that if we're incurring a cost to have you hooked into our system, you should pay that cost. So it's analyzed based upon our actual costs. So the cost of hooking to the system is like you say, the $600,000 or $7 million a year for all of our members. It's what we have to spend.
Thank you.
Representative Millett, co-chair.
Nice to see you here. Nice to meet you. I have just a couple questions. One, what's the percentage of your line loss? I mean, when you talk about transmission, what are you seeing as an... I'm sure you have an average line loss for transmission. Do you know what that is?
You know, and I'll take my stab at it unless Dave knows.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, and I'll follow up if I'm not right, but I think it's somewhere in the 12% amount. You know, it depends where it's coming from. If it's coming from Bradley, if it's coming from Chugach, if it's coming from Homer, from Healy, there's different line losses that are figured in. But I think about a 12% loss.
12%. I think AEA came out with a report that said that the average railboat loss was about 27%. And that's one of the issues that we've been talking about on a regular basis is how do we upgrade our transmission, especially with the power purchase agreements from renewable energies, which sometimes don't integrate well with other sources of energy. And we're seeing that in Anchorage with the wind farm and continuing to have to do the same thing that you're having to do with Eva Creek, which is ramp up and ramp down depending on the weather. My other question is, as a utility, what have been your steps for energy efficiency within your consumer base, not only your residential consumer base, but with your commercial building space? We've been pretty aggressive on passing energy efficiency grants and through the state, and have there been a lot of your commercial and your residential homes being either weatherized or going through the building efficiency program?
Yeah. Now you've hit something that I'm really interested in. through the chair, I might reply. The energy conservation program is extremely important at Golden Valley Electric, and actually while we've cut a number of costs, the board approved I think about a $300,000 increase to deliver energy conservation programs to our members. There are a lot of grants available. AEA has programs and others, and we work together with them to maximize our benefit. What I've come to, and we've got a new program campaign called the Power to Use Less, where we're trying to tell our members, you know, we're going to get you down to 20 cents a kilowatt hour, maybe a little bit lower, but if you really want to lower your electric bills, you're going to have to use less, and you have to be more efficient, and you're going to have to use better technology, get rid of that old refrigerator, and get rid of the two refrigerators in the garage or the two freezers in the garage. And we deliver a program called the Energy Sense Audits. We have Home Sense, and we have Business Sense, and we've seen our consumption drop. You call this sometimes demand-side management. Mm-hmm. And the other part of this, while we're talking about best business practices, because you'll hear utilities say, well, if you cut your consumption, then we're going to have to raise your rates to spread that same cost of delivering, hooking Representative Higgins up to the system. And it's cost of power, we're going to have to raise the rates. So we are saying you can serve and use less, and we will operate with less funds as well. So I've got some slides here and some information on our conservation program, but it's something that we are really going forward and doing. I recently, myself, did an Energy Sense audit on my home, so I could see what it was like when, and I had one like 12 years ago. But, you know, come out, they put timers on the cars for plug-ins of cars and advise people you only need to be plugged in 4 hours before you start. Don't plug it in all night. Mm-hmm. And your dryer vent needs to be cleaned out. Your refrigerator, the back of your refrigerator needs to be cleaned. I've had people tell me that they clean off the back of the refrigerator and get all the dust off, and it uses so much less electricity on the compressors to operate. You can save measurable amounts that you can notice in your bill. And we're starting to track the benefits, what the reductions are for members who've had the Energy Sense audit. So,
Follow up.
So on that, going back to the line loss, do you have recommendations for the legislature on transmission? I mean, this is a big debate within, I think Senator Cheerio has been here when we've talked about the Rail Belt Fund that, I can't remember what it was called, but it was a big, you know, fund that we had that every utility wanted to get their teeth into for transmission. So what's your recommendation to us as policymakers about upgrades to transmission, and who should bear the cost of that?
Well, let me preface through the chair the answer. Prefaces that I'm probably not the best person to answer this question, but I can give you a broad overview and tell you what we think. The rail belt transmission lines are not robust enough. They're not reliable enough. They need significant upgrades. AEA was provided funds to do a study, the Burlingame study that's come out, and it says we need to spend an awful lot of money. I don't even want to say the number because it'll scare you.
It's okay to say the number.
It's between $800 million and $1 billion to make sure that these interties can meet the needs of the rail belt.
The reliability.
And constrained. We can't get all of our Bradley out because the interties by Homer aren't big enough. And we want to make Bradley bigger and more efficient. So you're going to see we have a rail belt group called ARCTEC,
yep.
Alaska Rail Belt Cooperative Transmission Electric Company. I'm on the board of that, and we're making proposals to the legislature what we think needs to be done. The Burlingame study says, okay, you don't need $800 million right now. Let's phase it in over a number of years, but we need to start thinking about it. You know, who's going to pay for it? You talk to the utility managers, and they say, well, we can't put it all in the backs of the ratepayers. You know, we talk about the Bradley Lake model. Hey, half is from the state. Infrastructure, developing our infrastructure so we can have economic growth. Because I'll tell you, the same thing I heard in Fairbanks about economic growth, if the cost of energy go up in Anchorage, is going to be heard throughout in Anchorage, and it's been heard. It's been heard in the villages for a long time now. You know, this isn't new. It's creeping, and so, you know, the state has to decide whether they think this is worth investing in themselves. So the Bradley model is a half-half, 50-50. You know, would that work? You know, something like that might seem appropriate. So our tech's going to be coming around and talking to everyone about this as a group, as a unified group from the Rail Belt. And that's been part of the issue in the Rail Belt over the years, is that we haven't been speaking with a united voice, and we're working towards that end.
Follow up, and then Josephson, and then
Thank
Foster.
Thank you. I've participated in the RTEC groups on several meetings and was amazed that you could get six utilities together and have a conversation. And it seemed to be the only thing that they could agree on was transmission, that there was a need for transmission. My next question is going to be politically incorrect, and it's going to be tough for you to answer, but I'm going to ask you anyway. If the state is on the hook for transmission, is it reasonable to have six utilities? Is there a need to combine utilities and have a one utility? And would it be better for the consumer? I know it's going to be tough for you to answer that because you're your own utility, but it's something that we talk about on a regular basis. We are a small, small state. The Rail Belt has a small end user, but we have six utilities planning different generation projects. You've got MEA planning a new generation project. You've got Homer, you know, doing its own thing. You've got Chugach doing its own thing. And they all come to the legislature for help and assistance. And I understand that, but at some point, we are so unique in the way we generate energy in our rail belt, especially. So, do you think there's a value of and I know it's if I was the king for the day, that's the first thing that I would do is I would make one utility. But I mean, how would Golden Valley feel about some type of larger cooperative utility company that would, you know, manage generation and manage transmission much better than they do as six independent utilities?
Through the chair. See if I can make this a quick answer. it's something that's certainly been discussed, and ARCTEC was supposed to talk about taking over generation. You know, we got six utilities, and then now we have AEA coming on, you know, acting like another utility,
right.
Owning projects and looking to doing that. So, and we do have Homer and MEA who used to just buy power. The typical distribution cooperatives are now generating their own. So rather than kind of contracting and becoming one or a couple of utilities that generate, we're moving the other direction. So is that the wrong direction? There certainly can be economic cases saying, you know, that'll be one utility. We can save on all management and costs. And like any company that goes through a consolidation or an acquisition, you know, what's the better way to operate? What kind of efficiencies can you have? There's also, though, ideas that and concerns that when you start talking about this, that, we're gonna put all the generation in Anchorage, or we're going to put all the generation on the North Slope, maybe. And there's another thing, but we need to have generation in our geographic location. So it's territorial, you know, is that kind of a natural survival type instinct that the utilities would have here? Does that make it any good? I tell you that to the extent that we have different utilities operating, it creates synergies. There's some competition. And I'm seeing that now. I believe that, and I've told my board, look, we're going to have MEA producing power and Homer producing power. Pretty soon we're going to have four utilities in Anchorage that want to sell us power. We're going to have a better price. So there's some, the competitiveness that has these different utilities operating keeps it a little bit sharper. A little bit more on edge, maybe. I don't know if that's a good answer. But it's been debated a long time, and I think all the utilities ought to be open to whatever model serves the Rail Belt the best.
Well, it creates an incredible tension within the legislature, too, when every utility, my utility, wants a project, wants an upgrade, wants a state subsidy, and co-chair Isaacson's district wants an upgrade, wants I mean, it's been a, you know, I hope RTEC takes it up seriously. I know that they're battling, and you've worked on some transmission issues, but really, it's transmission is, like I said, 27% of the power loss, but generation is really what drives the cost of energy in the rail belt. And if we could get to a consensus through the utilities on a master plan for generation that isn't based on, you know, what's best for GVA or GH or MLMP and do what's best for the rail belt as a whole, I would really appreciate that, because it's tough. We listen to, you know, the woes of energy costs all over the state of Alaska, and we have so much money to spend on that. And so I guess my ask to you would be, in your group of RTEC, in which I enjoy going to those meetings, they're fascinating, but you all definitely have different constituencies and customers and missions within your own organizations, and it would be great if we could just get our arms around it.
And thank you. And for the time management aspect, we've got about 35 minutes. Rep. Josephson, then over to Rep. Foster, and then back to Rep. Nagy.
Thank you, co-chairs. My question is something you said was puzzling to me, and I sort of understand and sort of don't. You said that if your customers use less power, you'll charge them more. Can you explain that? I mean, I understand economies of scale and how you can't sort of adjust to lower rates immediately and may have to do the opposite, I think is what I'm hearing.
Well, to the extent we have a utility charge, and it's about 10 cents a kilowatt hour, that's spread amongst, you know, us a little over a billion kilowatt hours. If we have less kilowatt hour sales, that utility charge is going to have to go up because we have the same cost. In other words, we have the same depreciation expense, the same interest expense. If we have the same number of employees and everything else like that, but we sell less kilowatt hours, we have to spread it over fewer kilowatt hours and the cost goes up. So when our members start using less electricity, we have to find a way to cut our fixed cost. Okay. And, you know, the cost of power, part of the fuel and purchase power, that'll adjust. Okay. Because we're buying less coal, less fuel, less kilowatt hour. That's not a problem. That goes down. It's the utility charge, the fixed cost that we have to drop.
I understood that.
Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You had mentioned transmission upgrades about up to $1 billion. Have there been any calculations in terms of, and you said if the ratepayers had to assume that cost, it would be very substantial. How much are we talking? Do you have any idea on that? And then you had mentioned the Bradley Lake model, if it was 50% state, 50% ratepayers, maybe, you know what? And I know it could be a very complicated answer, too, so I, whatever you've got.
You know, I, through the chair, Representative Foster, I don't have the answer what it would do to rates. If it was a half of a billion, if it was $500 million, it had to be spread amongst all the users. I know that the CEOs, the management of the utilities in Anchorage, say it's something that their members, you know, it's just too high a cost. I can't tell what the cost is, but I think that's a good question. I should have the answer for you, so I'll have to get it. I don't know if that's your whole. That answer your question then?
No, I think that answers my question. I think I think there's a lot of ways you can probably cut that, like who, you know, the folks in Anchorage, do they assume much? You know, do people up in Fairbanks assume more? You know, you've got electricity coming from Bradley Lake, from Healy, and so it's, you know, it's, I think it's probably a pretty complex calculation to try and figure something like that out, but I thought maybe you might have a number, and I think that'll work for me for now, though.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Nugget.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I was listening to Representative Millett, I seem to kind of agree with that. Looking at combining the utilities at some point. I remember when I was growing up, people in Barrow were members of Golden Valley. That was a long time ago. And so, utilities have long reaches if they want to reach that far. So I think we should start thinking about that at some point, because there's so many sources that we can use to develop, the power. There's a resource, coal, natural gas, whatever, and, maybe we can start talking about super utilities to generate power to the state by regions or to because there's at least three, four regions in the state that anyway. Yeah. So.
Through the chair, if I have a brief comment to Representative Nagy's comments. I understand, that is something we really should consider, and it's been discussed. You have AVEC, Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, that 53 villages that it serves. So we've got one organization instead of 53 different organizations, and that's a model that you can point to has been very successful. And of course, I've been thinking too in Fairbanks. We'd like to get some of that 13-cent power. Let's have a postage stamp rate, and we'd love to see some of that the benefit of the lower cost in Anchorage come to us. But that aside, that's part of the discussion that goes on. It's like, well, who's going to have higher rates, and how are the rates going to be if it's one utility? Is it going to be one rate, the postage stamp rate, and lots of issues to discuss there.
Rep. Millett.
So now, as I understand, there's another utility that was formed in Fairbanks recently, a municipality utility that has $100 in the bank that's going to be also fighting for transmission and generation capabilities. Is that what's happening in Fairbanks?
Are you referring to the borough utility, the interior? Mm-hmm. That's for gas distribution system.
It's just for gas only?
Just for gas only.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. Continue on. We're on some of these solutions. We have a half an hour. I know that you still are getting into transmission, and we're going to be very interested in the Susitna Hydro and the HVDC transmission. The LNG trucking, you're probably going to touch just briefly on, because this is more, we'll have presentations from ADA and AEA on this, since the governor has tasked them with finding the financing for that. But please continue.
Okay. Yeah. It seems sorry I've taken so long talking about our system.
No, you've been answering our question.
But the solutions are out there, and I've listed some of them. It's not an all-inclusive list. We've already talked a lot about the gas purchases via the intertie, and so we kind of talk about the map of the state of Alaska and kind of show you there where the the bushes, that we call it a very large encompassing area, and the rail belt there is the over in the middle of the state. I just noticed here on the rail belt, we haven't updated the slide to include wind, because there's both wind in Fairbanks' Eva Creek and the Fire Island wind as well. You see the sources of all the generation in the different regions in the state of Alaska there. The rail belt is six distribution utilities. Golden Valley and Chugach are, in the cooperative world, fairly unique. There's only about six electric cooperatives that are like us, where we do our own generation, transmission, and distribution. Most electric cooperatives, and some over 800 of them, are distribution cooperatives. In other words, they buy their power from somebody. They don't generate their own power. They just buy it, and they just do a distribution to the homes. And then there's a few regional, they call them G&Ts, generation and transmission utilities. So the fact that we do the whole thing is fairly unique in the cooperative world. But the rail belt, we have interconnection all the way from Homer to Fairbanks. Here we got three primary generating utilities, but as we've talked about already, starting January 1, 2014, HOMA will be doing its own generation, and January 1, 2015, MEA will be doing its own generation. So we talked about the other independent operation there. So the rail belt, and I'm sorry this color isn't coming out very well on the screen, but the last intertie, and you can't see it, is the red line that's in the middle there. It goes from Willow to Healy, 177 miles. It was built in the 80s, and it was what finally connected the interior of Alaska to South Central. There's an Alaska Intertie Agreement. The Alaska Intertie is owned by Alaska Energy Authority. It's operated between and maintained by Golden Valley in part and by Matanuska Electric in another part. I shortened this a little bit. In the 1990s, we put in some Bradley Lake Hydro and the Bradley transmission lines so that we could get the Bradley Lake to all the way to the interior. And then in the 2000s, you can see that we built a second line from Healy. That's the northern intertie. And we also put in a battery energy storage system in Fairbanks, which is a collection of batteries in a building that about the size of a football field that provides us enough power up to like 37 megawatts for about 12 minutes, which is enough time to take a load when a unit goes down, if something happens. It's interesting, a lot of discussion about whether we could use these batteries to follow the wind. Hey, as the wind drops, we can let the batteries pick up the load. Our batteries aren't designed to do that. We're doing studies right now to see what we can do with the batteries and how that might work. I've talked to our people in dispatch, and they say, oh, we'll be using the batteries, and their manager says, no, you won't. The people in our dispatch office really want to have economical power, and they do everything they can to make sure it's as economical as possible. But so we have a dual line now from our Healy plant. It's best for reliability, and it allows us to bring all the generation, including the Healy Clean Coal plant, all the way to Fairbanks. The Alaska Intertie, with the red line in the center, needs to be upgraded. And the study, the Burlingame study, says it's a $200 million project. And that would be to build a second line. I think that's a better solution. Part of the issue that we've got here, and I think what's prompted the Burlingame study, is the fact that if we're going to build Susitna, the rail belts are going to need to be, the interties are going to have to be upgraded. I mean, we will never get the power from Susitna. They're projecting 600 megawatts of power. And Golden Valley is participating in the studies, and they're kind of like in an open season. We have to tell them how much power we would want from Susitna. And the problem is there's going to have to be a significant amount of intertie upgrades to make Susitna work. So it's tied to a big hydro project like that, and it's tied to in a sharing of utilities and resources across the rail belt that the interties be upgraded.
While you're on this slide, if you would, Mr. Borgerson, show us the two lines. You had used the example of a large cord and then an extension cord, or we've heard it as a four-lane highway down to a dirt road. I guess that would be you've got four lanes of transmission, as it were, between Healy and Fairbanks.
Fairbanks.
And then you've got that 177-mile strip, that's that dirt road, that small extension cord. That's your limiting factor, right? You pick it up again, the blue section covering Anchorage, Kenai area, that is also a full-capacity line. Could you expand on that?
In a general sense, what you've articulated is correct. There are some parts of the lines of the that are in by Homer and by Bradley that are not robust enough, that are not big enough, that need to be upgraded.
Okay.
and that too. But the big dirt road that we see from the interior is the Alaska Intertie. That is that red line in the middle. But from the Burlingame study, you know, the $800 million, only $200 million is this Alaska Intertie upgrade. There is a belief that a lot of the interties to build and be developed for growth and to take on Susitna going south, they're going to have to be upgraded as well.
So you've got 70, 80 megawatts of transmission capacity between the on the red line. You've got 170 or so to Fairbanks on the green line, and then you're saying the blue line, it's a mixture of 200 capacity down to 70 capacity, or what?
It's not quite like that. With the two lines, and maybe Dave, if you're comfortable, why don't you go ahead and make sure you got it right.
Well, we cannot technically add the two together, so it's somewhat less than 170, but it's enough to accommodate and was built to accommodate the Heliocline coal project, the second intertie. So the two interties together can handle the output of the red section, the 70 megawatts, plus Heliocline coal.
Okay. And to get the Bradley product and Chugach product, is the blue sufficient or deficient by how much?
But Mr. Chair, that's a very complicated question, which would be best be answered by the engineers of those particular utilities. There are sections that are robust enough, and there are certain areas that are in need of some upgrading. But the Burlingame study does spell that out, and would have to be our reference.
All right.
The another point of information is that certain sections of the intertie, specifically the second intertie between Healy and North Pole, was built to a 230 kV capacity, which with different transformers installed and different instrumentation, we can increase the capacity. So we have planned for some expansion, and any future construction would also plan for that expansion, although everything right now is energized at 138.
All right, thank you. Very good. Mr. Josephson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if Mr. Borgeson, if you have an opinion, and I know you're not, this wouldn't be your decision ultimately, it would be a number of other people's, but I'm thinking about the Susitna-Wautana project. The governor has set aside or recommended tens of millions more for that. And here I learned that the interties are insufficient. I learned that if Fairbanks wants to retrofit, for lack of a better word, to a natural gas system, those projects together are over $1 billion. And I'm just wondering why we're doing this dam if we've got all these other things that we need to do. I don't know if you want to give us your lay position, sort of. I'd say off the record, but you're on the record, so I don't know.
Through the chair, let me see how well I can dance here. the observation you've made here underscores the complexity of the decision and kind of why people are and utilities and you as legislators are kind of frozen. You don't know which way to go. It is very complex, and we can throw in the All-Alaska plan that's being developed, saying we should have a billion-dollar project on the North Slope and have HVDC lines deliver power throughout the state, and it would hit the rural areas as well. And part of that, is a result of the fact that technology has changed that's making that more viable, and you don't know what's going to come in the future, and you don't know what our fuel costs are going to do in the future as we make these very, very large decisions. The jury's still out on which way to go, but we're laying out what the needs are and what the thoughts are. I hear that Susitna, is extremely important. that it is a resource that we will have long into the future. The uncertainty and the pricing of our other natural resources like the gas and the oil is volatile enough and not proven such that, you know, that the hydro is important. How long, much longer is the oil going to flow down the pipeline? You've probably had a lot of studies on that. So that's critical to us in Fairbanks. If our cost is going to go up even more if we have to somehow truck in or deliver by rail oil. You got to think about it and plan. You know, I can't tell you where I'd go at this point. I'm still in the frozen stage, and that isn't maybe give you a lot of comfort as a president and CEO of an electric utility. But I can tell you that we're working on it, and we're listening at Golden Valley, and we're planning, and we're thinking, and we're strategizing, and we've got a board that's very engaged on that. But just like you, as legislators, take on all this information, someone's got to make a decision, make an investment, and we're doing that as best we can.
Thank you.
Representative Millett.
Thanks. Going back to and kind of going with what Representative Josephson is talking about is, you know, we have studied it. We've actually commissioned, I think, back in 2007, and we had RIGA, where the utilities came together through an appropriation from the legislature to study what a regional generation would gave us four options to do. That study was published in 2008. We're looking at 2012. None of any of those things that were recommended in the RIGA study have been implemented by the utilities. I mean, they talked about a joint action authority. They talked about a G&T group. There were you know, some good options, good viability options, and while you all participated, there has been no action. So I guess what I'm curious to know is, it going to take legislative action to get us all on the same page? We can study and we can talk about Susitna and about, you know, the wind farms and all that, but at some point, does the legislature or the governor need to take the lead on finding some solutions that the utilities will be forced into agreeing upon?
Some of the recommendations, the Joint Action Agency does exist. It's not fully participated in. ARCTEC is kind of the G&T start. We've worked on it, and, you know, there's going to be a long, great history ahead for Alaska. You know, so you got to take the time to think about it. And the role of the state, if the state wants to get into the utility business, you'll get to think about that. It's something that I don't think of any other state that's done. But, you know, then we're not like any other state. I don't know the answer to your question, but what I'll tell you is I recognize your frustration, and we'll take that to heart, saying that it's time for action and not talk and studies and decision-making and consensus building. That's what I can take, I guess, from your question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So before we leave the intertie issue, we know that there is capacity restraints, which then affect our ability to have low-cost fuel and generation, and that means we may have a long-term problem, and bringing Susitna into it. Susitna provides us with the long-term, but the short-term is going to cost us a lot of money to improve the system, system-wide. The big question that will be facing us as we look at a statewide plan and priorities, because we will be tackling this question, what priorities should we ask the legislature to be funding on a regional basis, that and should we do it on a statewide utility basis or something? So that will be coming up, and we will be having ADA and AEA and others come and talk to us more about this particular issue. But go ahead and continue.
You know, let me just talk to you about, I had a list of solutions there, and I want to also wrap up with a little update on the Healy Clean Coal. The trucking proposal would benefit Golden Valley, but the real interest in the getting natural gas to Fairbanks is the space heating savings. But you know, if we can get natural gas to Fairbanks or through the LNG process and trucking at somewhere in $13 an MCF range, we think it might be a little bit higher than that, $14. When we produce power at our North Pole plant, we'll save $26 million a year. So we really think that you know, not only does it benefit Golden Valley's ratepayers, bringing natural gas to Fairbanks will benefit the space heating needs, the people of Fairbanks for their space heating needs. It's big. There are big dollars on these savings. But, you know, the other thing is a plan like that, you know, there's a lot of assumptions built into getting natural gas to Fairbanks at $13 an MCF. A lot of assumptions, a lot of risks. And the price tag is big again. As Representative Josephson's comments, it's significant. So we're working on the LNG trucking project. Just briefly, Golden Valley has secured a gas contract, and we've got a site up in North Pole to put a regas facility. The governor has tasked that to ADA, and we fully expect and submitted a response to ADA, and look forward to working with ADA on that. So we're also concentrating on getting Healy Clean Coal started. We've already described to you that we have a bridge in this gas contract through 2015, and getting Healy Clean Coal started will allow us for many, many years to get this plant started. We were able to get our air permit in November 2012. It was a long, arduous process, and finally entered in what we called a negotiated settlement with the Environmental Protection Agency that was approved by Judge Beislein here in the state of Alaska, Federal Judge Ralph Beislein, in November 2012. So we have the permit. We expect to close and start working on that plant. Optimistically, we'll have folks on the ground in the plant starting to work July, August, this summer. We have to build a warehouse as part of the restart, and we intend to do that this year. ADA is going to sell us this plant. To remind you all, it's a $50 million purchase price. They've agreed to loan us $45 million for the restart. We, as part of our permit, had to agree to put in additional environmental controls. They're called SCR, an SCR system. The estimated cost of that is $40 million. The cost of restarting the plant and doing the upgrades that we need to is $26 million. And also part of our permit, we had to agree to make changes to the environmental technologies at Unit 1, the other plant in Healy. It's a lot to chew. Part of the belief on the board at Golden Valley is if we're going to operate a coal plant, it ought to be with the best environmental technology possible. It's the cost of producing with coal, and as you see, it's still cheaper than our oil-fired generation. So you can be frustrated about the process, but at the end of the day, we think that we'll be able to operate Healy Clean Coal without interruption and without any shutdown date. So we're happy to move forward. It's a big process to get this plant going. You talk about I saw the training. The training budget alone is $5 million. I commented that would be enough to pay for 4-year college degrees for a number of people. I you need to see more detail on that, but it's very expensive. I got another short 2-minute video of the Healy Clean Coal plant. If you're interested, yeah.
Sure.
It'll describe a lot of the plant.
Mr. Chair, before he does that, I'm interested in seeing that. Could you give me the numbers? Thank you. Could you give me the numbers again of ADA's investment in the plant? You just $50 million and $30 million.
No, that we're paying $50 million. You know, there's $117 million of federal money in that plant. And I think there's about $130 million of ADA money in that plant. I and that's a rough estimate. I believe they've got the plant on their books now at $42 million, but they've written off a significant part of their investment in that plant. You'll hear people say that it's a $300 million invested in that plant, and I don't know if it's that high, but it's approaching that. And I'll tell you, I still have our bankers who were up at Fairbanks yesterday saying, well, this is kind of a risky purchase. you know, is it going to work? And well, we'll see. Let me...
HCCP is located next to the Healy Unit 1 coal-fired power plant in Healy on Golden Valley property, so that the plants are adjacent to each other and share a fair number of common systems designed to support and enhance the operation of both units being operated as a joint facility. HCCP is approximately twice the size of Unit 1. It's a 50 megawatt Fuji generator. It's 11 stories tall compared to a 7-story tall Unit 1. The footprint of the plant is approximately twice as big for twice the capability. The plant is owned by the state of Alaska, ADA, Industrial Development and Export Authority. Well, as ADA went through startup and their 90-day demonstration test, there were technical issues that came up with the plant, but the major issue was economics. Back in the 90s, that plant was significantly more expensive than oil-fired generation at North Pole, so Golden Valley elected not to move forward at that time. Today, with oil prices where they were the past year and where they're projected to go, the economics have significantly changed that now makes coal much more attractive than it was 10 years ago. The sulfur dioxide emissions on HCCP are about one-third of Unit 1, and Unit 1 is about one-half of where it was 10 years ago. So as a result of that, both plants combined put out less sulfur dioxide than Unit 1 did 10 years ago. HCCP is basically in very good condition. There's really a relatively small amount of things that need to be done. When it was shut down in 1999, Golden Valley drained all of the water out of the systems, put everything in dry layup to prevent corrosion problems, to maintain the plant and its equipment in the best possible state for future startup. A lot of things do have to be done, though. It's kind of like an automobile that's been kept in garage for the past 10 years and not operated. We need to change oil and all of the components. Seals will have dried up, need to be changed. And all of the subsystems, we need to go and restart again because they haven't been operated. The short-term impact for Healy will probably be somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 jobs for correcting system deficiency and startup. On a long-term basis, we're probably looking about a dozen employees to operate the plant and somewhere over 400,000 tons a year of coal for Yucabeli coal mine. So all of that will be a significant economic boost to the Healy community.
I can kind of wrap up here because we're close to the end of the time and see if there's any final questions you might have.
Any further questions? Mr. Representative Higgins.
Well, first, I want to thank you for coming and appreciate sitting in the hot seat for me. You know, being in a Fairbanks in my whole life and working with GVA and all that, of course, you know, we've got the questions that we'd like to have answers to. One of the things that I would like to see is, you know, in Fairbanks proper, there's 32,000 people that live in the city, but there's 110,000 that live in a radius around there that we have to meet the needs of. In that, If you count on your hand, there's 10 power plants in that area, technically. Whether we can hook up to them or not, you know, I don't know. You guys know that better. As a perception, and as an owner, you know, a homeowner there in that area, what the common person sees is that GVA and other utilities don't work together to work towards the common goal of dropping our energy costs down. And you know, the example is there's clear Air Force Base, you know, that plant there, like you said, well, it's not hooked to the grid. Well, maybe 10 years ago you should have brought that up and said, maybe we need to hook you guys up so we can use that extra energy. You know, I mean, you should have reached out. Maybe you haven't told the public that. You know, in other words, be a little more transparent. But I think as the public goes, we need to know that you're doing everything in your power to bring down our energy costs, everything, including working with private industry that wants to put energy on the grid in that green section that you show. Because we don't want, you know, I don't know, the people I'm talking about aren't in the red section of that intertie. They're in the green that you say we have plenty of room to do it with. Yeah, there's some things you have to do to make sure it works, but the perception is that you're not doing everything in your power to do that. And maybe that's just a misconception that you can correct, and that would be helpful. But anyhow, I appreciate you being here. So that's all I have to say. Thanks.
Okay. You let him off easy.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much, Mr. Borgeson, Mr. Gardner, for being here and giving us a presentation of the current electric generation situation in the interior. The next Energy Committee meeting will be on Monday, February 4th. We will receive an update of the Alaska Housing Weatherization Program from Stacy Schubert, Director of Government Relations and Public Affairs, and John Anderson, the Weatherization Officer with Alaska Housing Finance Corp. We will also have a presentation on the LNG trucking project presented by ADA Executive Director Ted Leonard. I adjourn today's meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy at 10 a.m. We are